or less expensive for more cost toothbrush. You know, so yeah, there's the consumer side, there's the utility side, but I think some utilities are doing this. It's just probably few and far between, and of course that's an investment too for a lot of struggling utilities. You know, they're not necessarily flush with enough money to go start their own data collection and analysis, you know, that kind of thing.
I don't know. I think if that would come into being, other than just a research project, it would be have to be something that either a local or state or federal government policy that they'd roll out slowly but surely. But, you know, I mean, one of the useful aspects of a true AI would be something like that. Yeah, Chris.
Good comment. I don't know how you got on this subject, but I just caught the tail end of talking about the water delivery and pressure and whatnot. I do know a little bit about that. My brother was involved with that. And I can tell you this, in Suffolk County, it's much different than city areas. But there, it's not quite as easy as he suggested. The water comes from a lot of different wells, and when I had a lot, I mean hundreds of different wells. So each neighborhood has their own well, and it's just a little house with an old 50-year-old pump that just pulls the water up, has a small tank, and feeds the system the best they can. And it, there's zero intelligence in it. It has a little bit of filtration. Adds a little bit of chlorine, kind of a little automated drip thing, and it's a lot simpler than you think. There's no, a lot of people think it's a big central system, and you know, huge tank. There is none of that in Suffolk County. There's local well pump houses in the woods and all over Suffolk County. K2SDP.
Okay, I mean, that's something. Yeah, John?
Yeah, it's Jeff from Pelham, Roy. Wanted to make a comment on the appropriateness of governments collecting data and making decisions about kind of policy and... level is my particular interest because, you know, that's what directly affects us all here. I don't know how we got from ham radio to this, but here we are. It's nice that we're joined by that tone. And I just think that when you hand that that particular power to a state entity, you're giving away enormous amount of individual civil liberty. That's all I'm going to say about it without getting political. I don't think it should be done. I think that at every step that should be resisted in the most appropriate way, which is by voting and by making your opinions known to your representatives. Excuse me.
Eternal vigilance. You know, we can try. Will we succeed? I don't know. Governments are very oblique, and I don't trust Palantir as far as I can pick them up and throw them. But Palantir exists, and it's going to exist for the foreseeable future, And, you know, if you ever want to really be scared, you know, go YouTube the CEO of Palantir. He's the one of the creepier guys among the creepy techno bros out there.
Access on a day-to-day basis. When you have to submit, you know, papers about your house, papers about, you know, your car, your activity, that's what the state actually directly regulates on a minute-to-minute, day-to-day basis. And then, of course, the government, at a larger scale, Palantir is now playing a role, and that's Big Brother right there for sure.
AC2GS. Yeah, I'm sort of at all these kind of crackpot guys who have been talking about Big Brother, and when Palantir comes into existence, a lot of these strange guys say, oh, no, it's fine. That's not what we were talking about. We're talking about something completely different. So, you know, there's people out there ready to embrace Palantir. They picked a weapon of Sauron from the damn Lord of the Rings. What do you want them to do? Telegraph it? Do you want them to put a tattoo on your forehead? You know, they're not good guys. They're using Lord of the Rings analogies.
Elsewhere should use every method to protect and defend themselves. That's all. That's legal. Everything that's legal. AC2PL, back to you.
Okay, I agree with you, Jeff. I don't exactly know what's annoying this guy who's annoying us back. They're not really doing anything about the technical mess. They're just introducing their own pain in the backside behavior, but I guess you're free to do any nutty thing. But yeah, I mean, this all began with the discussion of data, you know, data servers and such, which Wesley brought up. So let's roll it back to Wesley. Anything else tonight?
And again, so. We have a few information. Microsoft in 2015 had the Pacific Ocean of California data center submerged. Then Scotland in 2018-2020 was having another one. China put in 2025 the underwater data center with Highlander Beijing. It has been called Highlander Beijing, and that was in Hainan Island, and they had at that time 100 modules, but of course they expanded. And then we have a subsea cloud, Nautilus data technologies. But so far, I don't believe they made any progress. So there are tries. Now, if we're talking about, let me drop. Okay. So what do you use which? Data center consumption, 5 million gallons of water per day. So we're talking about Mesa, Arizona, 4 million gallons of water per day. Aurora, Illinois, 5 million gallons per day. And the typical water usage for AI text generation is approximately in Washington State about 1.4 liters, and that's for 100 volts. So we're talking about significant usage of water that could actually be delivered to households to be more satisfied with life. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
That's been part of the argument. AI is inflicting a lot of cost in dubious investments, massive trillion-dollar investments include a lot of infrastructure and resources, and I don't think it'll pay off. A lot of it won't even actually be built, thankfully. Like I said, the recent research study suggests that half of these data centers won't be built. And the ones that will be built will probably be scaled back. Stargate had very, very amazing, optimistic objectives that have been scaled down every time I look it up. So, again, AI is going to stay in the news. It's going to impact us for good, bad, and indifferent, no matter what we do.
KF2CC.
Yes, hello, Brian.
Good evening. Just tuning in.
Okay, it's towards the end of our little segment. Soon we're going to pass the baton to Paul, but we still have a few more minutes.
That's okay, Roy. No, I'm just listening, waiting for the space net. I came in late.
Okie doke. I guess back to you then, Wes.
Okay. The last one, we were talking about consciousness and imagination. So we can understand the difference between consciousness and logical response to information and imagination. But then we're talking about fooling around people. That's what I said, it would be the last thing for today. So we had some rules standing about some strange technology, and I do thank you, Dr. Roy, that you responded about the value of that nonsense. But again, in every nonsense there is a sense. So the human heart generates significant electromagnetic field, which is actually the most powerful rhythmic electromagnetic field produced by bodies stronger even then the field generated by the brain. And I was thinking about the origin of electromagnetic wave from the heart. Back to you, and to AJ.
Okay, I mean, the heart is a very, very important pump. I assume most of you out there consider your heart to be important. And it uses ion channels to produce a current that produces a pacemaker and paces your heart accordingly and produces electromagnetics. Now, you know, Wesley kind of presented me a kind of absurd article from the New York Times of all things of equipment to detect a heartbeat miles away using squids. Superconducting quantum interferometer devices. Now, squids do exist and have been in and even movies. One of the cyberpunk type of movies included the use of squids. But they do not operate miles away. You cannot use a squid to detect a human being 100 miles away from you, which was the basis of that New York Post piece of garbage article.
Okay, so I was able to get the information that electromagnetic wave produced by the heart. Actually, if we have a conductor and we have electrical field, we have electromagnetic wave. So that field is strong enough to be detected 3 feet away, which is 1 meter. 3 feet is 1 meter away from the body. Using sensitive instrument like a magnetohydrograph. If you don't mind to say a few words about it.
Oh, not really. I mean, again, there are sensor equipment, the Holofax and other devices like squids that are capable of detecting very, very small magnetic fields. And you know, even though it's a strong relative field, relative to your body, it's not a very strong field. It dissipates rather quickly, so inverse square laws, and squids are very sensitive to picking up noise, and so it has to be a noise-free environment. So there are sensory devices that do these to one extent or another, but not infinitely. And the problem is it's very easy in an article that's published in a rag to extend the theoretical capabilities a billionfold. And, you know, no one's going to do anything against you because your editor is an idiot as well. We're amassing electromagnetic waves, and that's another problem, that there's a lot of random noise obscuring the signal that is your heartbeat. So 3 feet away, you can actually do it. 3 miles away, I don't think so.
Okay, so the whole controversy is, it's not because, I don't even know how to name it. What words to use for it? Making idiots from Americans. There's a lot of information about special CIA technology, and even manufacturers mentioned who is making that, and it's one of the defense contractors. And it says that when we had a problem in Iraq, those two pilots had to be evacuated. There is a device that is able to spot the heartbeat from the heart. And I was thinking first, are they talking about longitudinal wave, which is a mechanical wave of a heartbeat? You're standing next to the person and you cannot hear it. And then they're talking about the 40 miles away in the airplane or chopper that is making the noise by itself, a nonsense. And then they talk about some impurities in the crystal and whatsoever, and all of the BS. And I'm not really looking at what that nonsense says, but I'm looking at the amount of people who watch that nonsense. And then the question arises, do those idiots think that Americans are idiots? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
AC2GS, I would assume that they do. Unfortunately, you know, the New York Post has survived many, many, many years producing this dribble. The most important thing for any kind of source material is what is the original source. Now, if you kind of had some kind of press release from the CIA, that's one thing. But you don't. If you go and Google this, the only source material, original primary source, is Facebook and the New York Post. You might as well get my information from something drawn by with a crayon by an insane person in an asylum. It's not a reputable source, and so I just throw it out because it's pointless. You know, if I have to kind of deal with really absurd sources, then that, you know, I'm wasting my life. So again, if you get something and you find out its primary source is Facebook or the New York Post, throw it away. It's of no value whatsoever.
Thank you very much for that. The technology mentioned by them is called ghost marble, and it says along that sentence that it's top secret CIA technology developed by Lockheed Martin. Skunk Works that uses quantum magnetometry and artificial intelligence to detect faint electromagnetic signature of human heartbeat from long distances. Right? Am I not old enough to have problems with my brains? And I think that people like me, they're all around the same Americans. And somebody put such a nonsense and thinking that people are gonna buy it. Thank you, Eugene. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Yes, unfortunately, people buy all kind of rag. You know, I mean, there used to be a newspaper that every week would have some sighting of an alien that probed someone, unfortunately, or that dissected a cattle in the field or some other such foolishness. Anyway, a fool's aboard every minute. There's always a guy that you can get money out of with a grip. Anyway, thank you, Wesley. Thank you for your participation. Thanks to everyone's participation. It's already 10:21, and it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
Very good. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And, interesting topic tonight, but we started to talk about the Artemis early on tonight, so I guess we'll continue on with that. As most people know, because it was highly a big topic for the all the news stations, and of course online, liftoff on April 1st, the SLS system, all the way to the landing just the other day. And from everything I've read, it was generally a success. They had a couple of small glitches, but nothing to get wound up about. They had issues with the toilet system. They have a vent line that was freezing up. They were able to pretty much correct that at one point with rotating the whole spacecraft and pointing it to the sun, and that helped defrost it. So, you know, then there was another issue with the system later on, but they managed to get through it. And all the thrusters and everything pretty much held up. I'm worried about that. You might remember all the problems with Starliner going up to the International Space Station. It was supposed to go up for 8 days, wound up staying for like 8 months, all because of reaction control thrusters. They had nothing of the sort of that. And that worked out okay. The whole crew, three of them were ham radio operators, all seemed to be fine, all happy throughout the whole mission. On camera most of the time, they had a live feed, and they had two-way video possible that they did communicate with their families at one point, so they could actually see them. That worked. So
communications were fine until they got down to the end. You know, they had some issues just talking to the diver crew that was there to pick them up. You know, they actually operated an HT made by Harris. They called the Harris RF-7850M. And, you know, it looked this thing up. It cost, like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, it seems like. They said if you were to buy a new one, it would cost you, like, $9,000 from Harris. It looks like a big HT, but it works on all the bands, military bands. It actually can work on anything from 30 megahertz all the way up to very high frequencies, but the amateur bands, it would 2 meters, we cover frequencies between 420 and 450, but they have their own set frequencies into that thing. So apparently either something went wrong with that, or at one point Mission Control told Reed, you know, are you pushing the PTT button? I started laughing when I heard that. And anyway, they straightened that out. Temporarily, they were transmitting to the satellite system over to Houston, and Houston was relaying back and forth to the rescue queue crew that was surrounding the vehicle. But anyway, they eventually opened the door. The hatch got open and brought everybody out, put them on what they call a porch, which was a being raft. They put a floating raft around the vehicle itself, and then also put a crew. And then they float away, get away from the vehicle. The helicopter comes by, picks them up. They put two in each helicopter off to the ship, and they were back safely. They did a news conference and everything, so they were okay. So let's see if anybody wants to talk about the Artemis program, because you know, what happened during those nine plus days? WS-1.
Hi, Paul. It's Brian, KF2ZZ.
Good evening, Brian. How are you doing tonight? And I don't know if that's a courtesy tone that's jammed or whatever. But anyway, back to you.
Is someone intentionally keying up?
I don't know.
I've been watching the Artemis from beginning to end, and I'm glad that, you know, everything worked. I was pleasantly surprised, and, you know, some incremental improvements, but just very incremental, and we have to see what's going to really come of that. I really think that maybe three astronauts would have a little bit more room than four in that capsule. And it would be great if the capsule could go ahead and have a like a latch on it, so it could be picked up with a crane and put on board a ship like with SpaceX, instead of bringing them out into the water. So, you know, 1960s kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, well, the whole system
ship itself, the Orion. Orion float inside, and then they pop out the water surrounding it, and then that's how they get the Orion back. And that took, I think, about 4 or 5 hours for them to do that. It took about a little over two hours to get the crew out. They need to also be able to practice these things. They wanted to be able to use the helicopters. I mean, you know, theoretically, they could have put them on a boat and gone back to the boat, probably been back there before the helicopter showed up. They need to know that missions, if they wind up, you know, miles away for some kind of miscalculation, they want to be able to, have the helicopters pick up the crew and be able to do that. So it's all part of the everything was an experiment. Everything that they did, make sure all the environment inside, right, the water and the scrubbers for the CO2. Everything had to be operational, and they tested everything. You got to remember, on the first Artemis 1 that went out, they didn't even have, tanks for survival, for water tanks or air or anything. They didn't need that. But this one had all of that, and it needed to be checked out. So it all went well. They need to have 4 people because... And, you know, they have to show that the 4 can live comfortably on board, which they did. They drop it. A lunar landing. They're going to have the command module have 2 people in it to keep that thing operational while the other 2 are down on a lunar surface, but maybe up to, a week. They're not going to go down for maximum was almost 3 days for the last Apollo 17 mission. You know, they plan on, like, right from the start, putting a crew down there, maybe staying a week. So they have 2 people instead of the 1, like they did in the Apollo days, stay in the command module. And then the other 2 will be going down to the surface. So they needed to have that all work. And I thought about it, 16 feet, it's actually 16 and a half feet in diameter, where the Apollo module was around 12 and a half feet in diameter. The big difference, they did the math, they said that each crew member would have open up 60% more room than they had with the Apollo missions. I thought about my living room, is 16 feet across, and it looks doable. If you put 4 people in my living room, you'd probably be okay. And what they do is they store everything away when after launch they fold up those seats, they practically disappear in the vehicle, so it actually creates quite a bit of room. So I think they did okay with that. Back to you, Brian.
So, I have some thoughts. The first one I shared with you was by actually taking the capsule on splashdown and lifting it up with a grapple and putting it right onto the deck in a secure manner, and that eliminates a lot of things. The second thing is that what they could do is kind of do what the Russians do when they land on ground, and that's not a bad idea either. Another thought is that they could make the capsule, instead of just wider, they can make it taller with maybe two or three levels, and that would make it more sizable, but then again, you would have a lot more room to do a lot more things. And, you know, finally, I think that what they really should go ahead and do is cut the transit time in half. I can't understand why that can't be done. But aside from that, yeah.
Yeah, first you want to change the shape of the gumdrop shape. You know, that's aerodynamic, believe it or not, for what they need to do when they come barreling through the atmosphere. You know, it's roughly the same proportions as Dragon and Apollo and Mercury and Gemini. You know, it's the same idea. So, you know, you can't just make it a long cylinder type of thing and then put a cone at the top. The way the heat travels around the spacecraft, you know, you wind up with different hot spots. They wouldn't be able to handle that. I guess they'd have to put maybe tiles around the whole thing like they did with the shuttle, probably. That's another thing with the heat shield we talked about a little bit earlier on. Coming through the atmosphere, again, the 16.5-foot diameter shield needed to protect the astronauts inside. The astronauts' temperature inside, they never felt any difference. But the outside, that's another story. And the heat shield is designed to really protect them up to 5,000 degrees. In other words, the shield itself could actually get up to 5,000 degrees and some re-entry. They believe that, from what I read it didn't really go above 3,000, maybe 3,200 degrees. But, you know, I'll get final reports later on, eventually. Now, what people don't realize is that heat shield, as it's pushing air as it comes through, it's creating a more or less a couple of inch separation between the ionization of the atmosphere and the heat shield itself. There's a space, you know, that's why they come through one end. You know, if it came through with a pointed end, it wouldn't work. The blunt end is creating this area in front of the whole heat shield. And by the way, that atmosphere that's becoming ionized, if you were to actually stick a thermometer in that, 3,000 degrees. It wouldn't be 5,000 degrees. It would be 18,000 degrees. Think about it. You can't. You know, if you have 3,000 degrees on Earth, not turning into this, you know, the same kind of a plasma that you have when it comes through the atmosphere. That air is being compressed so hard that the molecules are separating. It's separating the electrons and the positron, they're just separating them. Protons and electrons are not connected anymore, and that creates an ionization around the whole, you know, spaceship. You know, that temperature is 8. But the weight, by the way, was about the same. Artemis II was about 300 pounds heavier. even though they had a crew on board and all the extra stuff that they needed, you know, for a crew, they managed to keep the weight pretty much the same. Artemis 1 came through 14 minutes, you know, coming through the atmosphere instead of 8. And the reason for that is they wanted to come in, bounce, you know, and then with the thrusters moving around and aerodynamically, it pushes, you know, it creates a lift, and they wind up coming back up, and then they go back down again. In doing that, the temperature of the heat shield, you know, starts migrating further and further deeper into the heat shield. And when they came back out into a slightly lower temperature, the little air molecules inside the heat shield started to expand, and it created a popping problem. Pushing parts of the heat shield away, so that if you look at the original pictures of Artemis 1 heat shield, you could not only charred, it's supposed to be charred, it's called an ablative material, it's supposed to like go off smoothly, essentially taking the heat away from the shield, but there was actually chunks, little chunks missing here and there, and that bothered them. It wouldn't compensate for that, they decided, well, we'll come in direct and we'll make the time that we spend shorter. This way, it'll be less time for the heat to migrate deep into the heat shield and chance of creating these little pit reactions throughout the heat shield will be mitigated. And that's what they did. I haven't seen the pictures yet. I don't think they've released the pictures of the heat shield. Let's see what that looks like. Compare that to, you know, one compared to two. Anyway, that's an update on what I know about the heat shield and the reentry procedure. Back to you, Brian.
I was reading that they have a new process now for the heat shield that they want to go ahead and try. They have it ready to use with Artemis 3. And I guess they have to do some further testing, make sure that that's going to be okay. That should correct that. You'll never know until they go ahead and take a look at the heat shield right now and see what condition it's in. But, you know, it's just not, like I said, incremental, very incremental. And I think there are ways to enhance it. I mean, one toilet on board, that's tough, you know. Build it a little bit higher, you know. Maybe you could squeeze in a second toilet. Lots of things that could be considered.
Hello, Chris. And, yeah, well, one toilet's better than none. Apollo system had none. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks, Paul. The suggestion, the guy, Brian, making it a little bit bigger, you have to realize that every single pound that they put on that thing, if they extend it to make it a little bit higher, that's pounds of weight, and it's hundreds of thousands of gallons or pounds of fuel for the rocket to get that extra pound up. I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but it's ridiculous per pound what it takes to get it off the planet. So it's you know, they want to make it as small as possible. Not as, they're not trying to make it comfortable. Same with if they added a second toilet. It would be awfully expensive, not money-wise necessarily, but to get this thing off the ground. But Paul, I also sounded very humorous. I caught that comment, you check the PTT button when they landed. And I also found it very humorous after it's about a million-mile trip on the moon, re-entry, the rocket takeoff, all of that. They land in a drink and they can't get a phone call to get picked up. And I don't know if you noticed, but when they first opened the hatch, one of the guys on the little boat jumped in to, you know, help them inside. And about 30 seconds later, he popped back out the hatch just with his head out. And he had a sat phone in his hand and was trying to get a signal on the sat phone because they don't work when they're covered up. It's line of sight. And I thought it was hilarious they just had that little communications issue. But, I'm sure there was a collective laugh around the world from ham radio as soon as you found the PTT button. Back to you, Paul.
And especially with three of them having the ham license. But, yeah. I didn't see the guy... I gotta get a bigger screen. I didn't see the guy with the HD in his hand, you know, the sat phone. Okay. Yeah. And I never heard definitively what was wrong with their radio system. Something on board the, you know, space antenna? Did you hear any final result on that, Chris?
I have not. Surprisingly, I haven't heard anything about it. I'm sure we will eventually, but you know, I wondered if an external antenna burned off, or you know, something like that happened, or it could be as simple as they started powering things down. Somebody powered the antenna tuner or piece of the radio transmitter or something. Something might have just gotten powered down. Who knows? We'll find out, though, I'm sure.
It's like something on a radio news line, you know. That would be a typical story they would do. Yeah, okay. What was I going to say? The landing. Brian brought up landing on land. Of course, the shuttles land on land, and the Russians land on land with their progress. Russians knew they had to do it from day one because of the geography. They're not close enough, really, to the water to have water landings, but they never had that. Starliner lands like that. They've landed, let's see, three of those things so far, and right on the money in White Sands, New Mexico. Down they have half a dozen big airbags that, you know, inflate right toward the end, you know, after the heat shield is separated and all. That works quite well. But on this one, they designed Orion to land in the water. Originally, Orion was designed to be reusable as well, but they don't plan on doing that. Although they might take components and parts from each Orion and, you know, shift it to a new Orion. The next one that will be going up with a new improved heat shield, they're definitely going to do that. Unfortunately, it's going to be an orbital mission around Earth. So when they come back to the Earth, they'll be coming back at 17,500 miles an hour. They won't be duplicating the 25,000 mile an hour speed that is needed to, for the lunar missions when it comes back. You know, Apollo, they're all the same. In fact, only one Apollo mission, I think, it was the last one, 17, came through the atmosphere, maybe about 100 miles an hour faster than Artemis 2 did. So they're all about the same number, 25,000 miles an hour. So you won't be getting a true test of how good the new heat shield works until they actually land on the moon, because the the way it lines up now, and anything can change because this administration changes things, you know, at the drop of a hat. Right now the plan is to take Artemis 3, an orbital mission around Earth, and they're hoping to be able to dock with either one or both of the landers that NASA is contracted out for, one by SpaceX and one by Blue Origin. I mean, ideally, they would like to have by next year two human landing system vehicles in orbit. And then as they're in orbit, here comes Orion, you know, the Artemis 3 up to dock with the one of the vehicles. And then with that, they'll be able to transfer the crew. They'll actually be able to separate from Orion and, go a distance apart and eventually connect. And then just after doing that, fly over to the other human landing system and dock with it and do the same thing. They'd like to be able to do both of those things all in one mission, just to see how that all works. And then come back and land. Those landing vehicles will eventually burn up in the Earth atmosphere. They'll be designed on them. So it's kind of a weird thing that three was originally going to be the first one to actually land, came to Artemis 4 and Artemis 5. This is all supposed to take during 2028. I'm not going to place my bet on that one, but that's what they plan on doing. 2028, you're going to have two missions, 4 and 5. Both will be landing on the moon with either one or both of these landers that are, from what I see, nowhere near ready. Right, although I think Origin is doing pretty good. SpaceX, nothing but problems. In fact, recently they just had one of their engines burn up on the testing. They have a new Raptor engine that they're developing, and apparently the thing not only burnt up but blew up on a test stand. SpaceX hasn't put a Starship into a space, never mind orbit, since what, last October? And that was supposed to go up in March, April, now they're saying May. This new Starship. So we'll see when it's into orbit. That won't even. Again, that's a suborbital flight. They got to be able to put the thing into orbit. And then on top of that, they have to put a duplicate of the lander into orbit so that Artemis 3 could dock with it. After that's successful, SpaceX would have to take a Starship and another lander, send it all the way to the moon, and land on the moon without a crew, and then take off from the moon. All this has to happen before 2028? I don't think so. And the other company, which is Blue Origin, I think has more of a shot. They have the Blue Moon Mark II lander capable. Both vehicles, by the way, could probably land four people. But the plans are to land two people on the moon and then come back up and dock with Orion. They have a better shot. I mean, they got a long way to go, too. They have an engine, actually three engines, that will be on the descent module when when they do land, and each engine is called the BE-7. BE-7 engines are liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Each one has 10,000 pounds of thrust, so it has 30,000 pounds of thrust. To give you a comparison, the descent lander on the Apollo LEM that landed was around 10,000. So, I mean, you'll have the equivalent of three times that amount. When Blue Origin, they call it Blue Moon Mark II, lands on the moon. They're not working on it. The one that's ready to fly looks very similar to the Blue Moon lander, is called Blue Moon Mark I. Mark II is the crew version. One is the uncrewed version. It's a cargo version. They will eventually, eventually you're going to have a moon base. You're going to need to supply stuff. Blue Origin is this cargo vehicle, which is ready to fly this year. Well, before the end of this year, but there's a possibility it might go up like June or July. It will fly to the moon and land with its one engine. It has, I mentioned, the crew version has three BE-7 engines, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. This one has one, but it's a smaller vehicle. It's pretty big. I mean, it's bigger than the LM. So they plan on landing this thing with one engine, and this way they could, well, check out a few things, the computers, and make sure the ability to actually land on the moon without a crew, and then actually take off again. That all has to be accomplished by Blue Origin with the cargo version doesn't have to take off, but the lander, they'll probably have to prove to NASA that they could actually send a crewed lander to land by itself and then take off before that thing is used. And again, all this has to happen before 2028. So I'm not sure if that's all going to work out, but we'll see. Any comments? WS1.
This is Brian, KFTCG. I have a comment and an idea. Since the Artemis uses two solid rocket boosters, why don't they just go ahead and outfit, instead of having a capsule on top, why don't they re-engineer and bring back the space shuttle, and then in the cargo bay of the space shuttle, they could have a lunar lander that comes out from the from the space shuttle going around the moon, and then comes back into it, and then you take the whole thing back.